Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. We're now approaching the end of the 19th century. In this episode, we look at the dominant school in this period, the Neo-Grammarians, who had their center of gravity at the University of Leipzig. The Neo-Grammarians brought the technical side of comparative historical linguistics to a new level of sophistication, and at the same time articulated a precise and yet austere philosophy of science underlying their endeavor. The Neo-Grammarians are also interesting from a sociological point of view, since it's probably fair to say that they were the first group of linguists who consciously conceived of themselves as forming a movement. Up until now, we've spoken mostly about individual scholars and their theoretical and methodological innovations. The most prominent of these scholars passed on their views and methods to their students, and in this way established schools. But the Neo-Grammarians were the first collective of peers who were bound together by an explicitly articulated set of doctrines. The Neo-Grammarians are remembered above all for their doctrine that sound change proceeds absolutely regularly, without any exceptions. Or to quote their 1878 manifesto, all sound change, inasmuch as it proceeds mechanically, takes place according to exceptionless laws. So what exactly does this principle mean, and why was it such a big deal? In order to answer these questions, let's first look at some of the difficulties with which linguistics was confronted in this period. The story of comparative historical linguistics from Bopp to Grimm to Schleicher is one of increasing precision in working out the historical changes that have occurred in languages and in formulating the laws governing those changes. But as we've commented on a few occasions, there was always an annoying remainder of forms that would just not fit into the laws of historical development. In the 1870s, however, linguists made a series of technical breakthroughs that solved many of the long-standing problems and reinforced the regularity of sound change. Let's look at one classical example, the solution to a persistent exception to Grimm's law that was published in 1877 by Karl Werner. We, of course, covered the rudiments of Grimm's law back in episode 2. The problem with Grimm's law was that there were several key words in the Germanic languages that didn't seem to obey it. A famous example of this is perhaps the word for father. On the evidence available to us from the oldest Germanic languages, we'd want to posit, in Proto-Germanic, the reconstructed form father, with a voiced fricative in the middle. But Grimm's law tells us that the form should be father, with a voiceless fricative in the middle, since in other Indo-European languages, this consonant is a voiceless plosive. The word for brother, however, does behave properly. Grimm's law and the evidence available from the oldest Germanic languages agree. The reconstructed form should be brothar, with a voiceless fricative in the middle. Karl Werner's breakthrough was to look in greater detail at these problematic words like father to find a subtle difference in their phonetic structure that conditioned the different sound changes. Proto-Indo-European had a free and movable accent. That is, in polysyllabic words, the stress could fall in different places. This movable accent was preserved in many older Indo-European languages, including older stages of Sanskrit, but had already been lost in Proto-Germanic, which had a fixed accent on the first syllable. Werner noticed that in the Sanskrit word for father, the stress was on the second syllable, but in the word for brother, it was on the first syllable. You'll have to excuse my Sanskrit pronunciation for this example. Unfortunately, Panini was not available to help out with this episode. But basically, the roots of the Sanskrit forms would have sounded approximately like pitar for father and bratar for brother. With this additional phonetic information to hand, Werner was able to augment Grimm's law. To put his additions in present-day terms, we'd say that in Proto-Germanic, fricatives became voiced when they were not word initial and the following syllable had been stressed. This is what happened in the word for father. The t sound, present in Sanskrit pitar, for example, became a fricative, as Grimm's law would predict, but was then also voiced because of the placement of the stress. This produced the reconstructed form father. But when the stressed syllable preceded the middle fricative, it remained voiceless. This is what happened in the case of the word for brother. Porthar has a voiceless fricative. So to make these exceptions go away, all that was required was to refine Grimm's law to include greater phonetic detail. So Werner's great achievement, which was soon highlighted by the leaders of the neo-grammarian movement, was to stick to his science. Werner showed that there were, in principle, no exceptions and no limits to the comparative historical method if the linguist simply doesn't give up and works away uncompromisingly on the data. So who were the neo-grammarians exactly? This question doesn't have a definite answer. There was a hard core of ringleaders driving the movement, who we can uncontroversially identify as neo-grammarians, but there was also a much broader periphery of those who were more or less involved, or who sympathized with the movement to varying degrees. The term ringleader to describe the movement's core members is chosen consciously here, for its connotations of rebelliousness. The neo-grammarians had a reputation for being a group of punk scholars who were disrespectful of their elders and who sought to instigate a revolution in linguistics. The English term neo-grammarian is a not entirely satisfactory rendering of the name that was used for them in Germany, the Junggrammatiker, literally the young grammarians. This designation was originally applied from outside the group, and was intended to be an ironic play on the name of various political movements at the time, such as the Young Turks, a group of young political reformers in the then Ottoman Empire, who were uncompromising in their efforts to push through their modernizing reforms. An anecdote at the foundation of the neo-grammarian movement may help to illustrate why they had this reputation. The core clique of the neo-grammarians were students and young scholars in the orbit of Georg Curtius, professor at the University of Leipzig. Curtius belongs to the same generation as Schleicher, and Curtius and Schleicher, in fact, had an amiable professional relationship. One day in 1876, Curtius went away travelling and left his pupil Karl Brugmann in charge of his journal Studien zur griechischen und lateinischen Grammatik during his absence. In this period, it was common for scientific journals to be personally identified with their editors. Such was the importance of the editor in defining the direction and character of a journal. This journal was often referred to simply as the Curtius-Studien. While the master, Curtius, was away, Brugmann published in the journal two articles that proposed radically different reconstructions in Indo-European from those accepted by Curtius and the older generation. In addition, Brugmann repeatedly criticized the methodology of his seniors. When Curtius returned from his travels, he was absolutely horrified. He wrote a small afterword to the issue Brugmann had edited, in which he discounted responsibility for its contents. And with the next issue, he cancelled the further publication of the journal altogether. Brugmann's rather aggressive performance in Curtius's journal is generally considered one of the first clear expressions of the neo-grammarian movement, and is representative of the movement's pugnacious character and the irritation it provoked on the part of the elder generation. In 1878, Brugmann teamed up with his colleague Hermann Osthoff to launch a new journal, the Morphologische Untersuchungen, or Morphological Investigations. From the beginning, this journal was intended as an organ for the emerging movement. The first issue contains a preface penned by Osthoff and Brugmann, in which they set out a manifesto for this new direction in language study, and in which they claimed the designation Junggrammatiker for themselves, which up until that point had only been used facetiously by those outside the movement. The central theoretical claim of Osthoff and Brugmann's manifesto is that previous research in comparative historical linguistics lacked a proper scientific foundation. They accused their predecessors of having only looked at languages without trying to establish underlying principles. In contrast to this, the neo-grammarians wanted to base their investigations on a solid foundation that accounts for how human language actually functions in the minds and mouths of speakers. This is how Osthoff and Brugmann put it in their manifesto. The older language research, no one can deny, approached its object of study, the Indo-European languages, without having a clear idea of how human language lives and develops, what factors are active in speaking, and how working together these factors cause the progress and reforming of the material of language. Languages were eagerly studied, but the speaking human was studied too little. Osthoff and Brugmann go on to say that linguists need to turn away from their fixation on analysing the lifeless words on the page from ancient languages and trying to reconstruct the forms of a putative proto-language. Instead, linguists should look to modern languages to gain a clearer idea of the processes active in language. In particular, linguists should examine the minority forms that we find in non-standard dialects, since these show all the subtle shades of variation across languages. Contemporary dialects give us direct access to the real living language. We don't have to puzzle out obscure abscriptions in dead tongues and guess how they might have been pronounced and precisely what they might have meant. Driving language change, according to Osthoff and Brugmann, is the tension between the opposing forces of sound laws and analogy. This approach to language change has already been demonstrated to great effect by their young Leipzig colleague, August Leskin, in his 1876 book, Declension in Slavic, Lithuanian, and Germanic. And it was elaborated on later by other members of the neo-grammarian camp. According to this view, sound laws proceed without exceptions. That is, when a sound change occurs in a dialect, it should be found in all phonetic environments that meet the same conditions. These regular sound laws are primarily motivated by the physical facts of articulation, although in fleshing this idea out, the neo-grammarians were cautious enough to acknowledge that there's a complex interaction between physical and psychological processes underlying all sound change. Balancing out the sound laws is analogy. Analogy was an existing concept with a range of senses, but Leskin used it specifically to mean how words are attracted to inflectional paradigms to which they may not belong etymologically. An example of analogy in this sense is the plural form of the word cow in present-day English. The plural is, of course, cows, which is formed by adding an S to the root of the word. This is the pattern used by the vast majority of nouns in modern English. But up until the 17th century, the more common plural for cow was kine. At this time, the word cow belonged to the same inflectional paradigm as such words as brother, with the plural brethren, and child, plural children. But through the process of analogy, cow was attracted to the larger class of nouns with a plural formed with s, and the plural became cows. In his 1876 book on declension in Slavic, Lithuanian, and Germanic, Leskin successfully used migrations across paradigms of this type to explain away apparent exceptions to sound laws. In cases where attested sound changes could not be made to fit with accepted rules, Leskin argued that the attested forms were the product of analogy. In these instances, just like with cow and cows, new forms had been spontaneously created to accord with existing patterns in the language, using processes that fell outside the sound laws. Other members of the neo-grammarian camp extended this notion of analogy to encompass all kinds of changes that clashed with the sound laws. Their frequent and at times very loose use of this notion of analogy was a point on which they're often criticized, as we'll see in the next episode. But in putting forward these positions, were the neo-grammarians really saying anything new? We've already encountered linguists who argued that we need to turn attention to the speaking human in order to avoid the danger of hypostasizing languages as organisms with a life of their own. This line of argument is a mainstay of the critiques of the materialist theory of August Schleicher, which we've encountered in previous episodes. In their manifesto, Osthoff and Brugmann accorded a prominent place to Steintal for the way in which he incorporated psychological factors into his accounts of linguistic processes. But we'll recall from episode 6 that Steintal's signature project, Völkerpsychologie, which he formulated in collaboration with Lazarus, was still rather abstract. It looked to the putative shared mentality of the nation that speaks a language. The more business-like, down-to-earth approach that Osthoff and Brugmann were advocating, and which only became more pronounced as the neo-grammarian movement gathered steam, may remind us much more of the ideas of William Dwight Whitney, which we explored in the previous episode. The neo-grammarians and Whitney did indeed have a very close relationship. Whitney was a personal friend of many of the neo-grammarians and visited them on his trips to Germany in the 1870s. August Leskin translated Whitney's Life and Growth of Language into German in 1876. Although Osthoff and Brugmann didn't mention Whitney by name in their manifesto, Brugmann did later write a contribution to an 1894 conference dedicated to the memory of Whitney, who had died the previous year. In this letter, Brugmann highlights Whitney's pioneering achievements in studying the foundational questions of the life of language, as he put it, and the influence Whitney's thinking had on the development of the neo-grammarian movement. But even if the neo-grammarian revolution didn't come out of nowhere and had clear and acknowledged antecedents, the neo-grammarians did, of course, develop their own theoretical and methodological apparatus. A key figure in this connection is Hermann Paul, who provided a comprehensive theoretical framework for the neo-grammarians in his book Prinzipien der Sprachgeschichte, that is, Principles of Language History. Paul's Prinzipien first appeared in 1880 and went through 5 editions up until 1920, 1 year before his death. Throughout this period, his book was widely cited as the clearest and most influential statement of neo-grammarian theory, to the point that it's often referred to as the neo-grammarian Bible. The central contribution of Paul's work is to outline what he called a Prinzipienwissenschaft, or a science of principles, that deals with the functioning of human language. In line with the existing neo-grammarian consensus, Paul argued that language is a complex phenomenon. It's the product of individual people interacting with each other in order to exchange their ideas in the medium of speech. Crucially, language is also a historical phenomenon. The only scientific study of languages, according to Paul, is in terms of their historical development. In order to be able to capture the multifaceted phenomenon of language, we need to draw on the results of several different sciences. In particular, we need on the one hand psychology in order to be able to understand the processes active in people's minds as they formulate their speech and understand the speech of others. And on the other hand, we need physiology and physics to be able to understand how people articulate their speech and hear the speech produced by others. The Prinzipienwissenschaft that Paul proposes is supposed to be a science which takes into account the results of all of these other sciences that treat specific aspects of language, and which then states higher-order principles of how these elements come together to bring about historical development in language. The psychology that Paul believes is relevant to this enterprise is individual psychology. Like Osthoff and Brugmann, Paul acknowledged the role of Steintal in studying in detail the psychological forces behind the functioning of language. But Paul was very clear that he meant only Steintal's psychology of individual people. Paul was highly critical of Völkerpsychologie for its attempt to subject an imagined collective mind of the nation to psychological analysis. This is another point where the neo-grammarians had more in common with Whitney than with Steintal and their other German predecessors. We'll recall from the previous episode that Steintal sought in 1875 to deflect Whitney's critiques by saying that Whitney lacked philosophical sophistication. But only a few years later, in 1880, Paul was able to write on the first page of his Prinzipien der Sprachgeschichte that our unphilosophical age, as he put it, is suspicious of anything that smells of the metaphysical speculation of earlier language philosophy. Anglo-Saxon common sense had managed to infect even German science. Concepts like the Volksgeist, or at the other extreme, the alleged natural organism of language, belong to this former speculative period in German science. Instead, in accord with the sober realism of the scientific world towards the end of the 19th century, Paul insisted that the only entities that really exist are individual human beings interacting with one another. For this reason, Paul could not endorse Lazarus and Steintal's Völkerpsychologie. Their talk of a Volksgeist was for him unwarranted and unscientific. There was no good reason to imagine that such a thing really existed. These entities, argued Paul, are an abstraction from the observed regularities in a community. Following this line of argument, Paul even denied the existence of a grammar of a language. There is no shared entity of which speakers partake, but rather just individual speakers with their own ways of talking. From this we can extract the Sprachusus, the average or customary usage in the speech community, but this is merely an artifact of analysis and not a real thing. We see then that the neo-grammarian movement was characterized by a revolutionary spirit that sought, on the one hand, to achieve uncompromising methodological precision, and on the other to sweep away the perceived theoretical confusions of the previous generations. In a way, these assertions of revolution seem to be a simple recapitulation of a pattern we've constantly observed right from the beginning of linguistics as a discipline. It seems that almost every generation believed it was starting anew and righting the wrongs of their predecessors. From its beginnings in the mid-1870s, neo-grammarian fever took hold on the discipline of linguistics and in many ways defined the field. Linguists were either members of the neo-grammarian movement, or at least sympathizers, or they joined the ranks of their vociferous critics. In the next episode, we look at some of the various directions from which the neo-grammarians were criticized, and how these critiques influenced the further development of the discipline.